From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Alex Smith. Susan Wilson is away this week. On today's show, we'll look at Kansas's privatization of Medicaid, which began on January 1st.
Hear about a new biography of political leader Leon Jordan. And a local economist finds a disparity in the funding of research by black scientists.
If you get a diversity of perspectives, you get a diversity of approaches to science, and it leads to better science.
Plus, a remembrance of jazz saxophonist Eddie Saunders.
You know, when Eddie would play a riff, for instance, you know, he wouldn't just play da-da-da-da-da-da. He would play wah-wah-wah-wah-wah-wah. There was a shape to each note. It was sculpture.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Alex Smith, sitting in for Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
To many Kansans, Medicaid is just another welfare program, but it's really much more than that. Yes, it provides health coverage for low-income mothers and children, but it also serves as a safety net for elderly Kansans. And it's critical to keeping disabled Kansans in their communities and out of more expensive state hospitals. But the Kansas Medicaid program is undergoing big changes. The state has hired 3 for-profit companies to manage Medicaid as part of Governor Sam Brownback's CanCare initiative. Today, we're launching a week-long series on CanCare, produced by Jim McLean of the KHI News Service and Kansas Public Radio's health reporter, Brian Thompson. We begin with this report from Jim McLean.
Here's what you absolutely need to know about Medicaid to the 380,000 Kansans on it. It's a really important program, and Governor Brownback's CanCare initiative is making some really big changes to it. At nearly $3 billion, Medicaid is the second most expensive thing that state government does, taking a backseat only to public education. It's also somewhat unique in that it's a shared responsibility of the state and federal governments. About 60% of the money needed to fund Medicaid comes from Washington. The rest comes from Kansas taxpayers. Low-income disabled and elderly Kansans depend on Medicaid for health care and for other services that help them remain independent. And how about this factoid? Medicaid covers more than 40% of all the births in Kansas.
That means 2 out of every 5 births is paid for by Medicaid.
That's Scott Bruner, a senior analyst at the Kansas Health Institute, the nonprofit parent organization of the KHI News Service. Bruner is a former state Medicaid director and an expert on the program. He says most people know Medicaid serves low-income women and children, but he says many don't realize the program also helps pay for nursing home care for tens of thousands of elderly Kansans after they've exhausted their financial resources. And he says other Medicaid services help Kansans with physical and developmental disabilities live more independently.
Medicaid as a program nationwide has been one of the key drivers of getting people that 20 years ago, 30 years ago, would have spent their lives in state hospitals or other kinds of institutions, can live successfully in the community.
Elderly Kansans and those with disabilities make up only about 30% of the people in Medicaid, but they're responsible for almost 70% of the program's cost. Far less is spent on women and children, even though, as Brian Thompson reports, they are by far the largest group served by Medicaid.
Pregnant women and children make up about 2/3 of the state's Medicaid population. One of these young mothers is Jessica Corrado of Pittsburgh.
I think I was working as a waitress, and I had no insurance through either my parents or anything. I wasn't married at the time, so I couldn't have insurance through my spouse, and I didn't have a job that offered coverage like that.
Corrado applied for Medicaid when she learned she was pregnant.
When I became pregnant with my daughter, I was 17, and, you know, Medicaid really helped me because I felt like I had no other way of paying for my care and paying for all these hospital bills.
Corrado has asthma and allergies, so she spends more time at the doctor's office than her daughter does. Corrado now works for the Community Health Center of Southeast Kansas. She sees people every day who have no insurance coverage, and she knows that even a routine labor and delivery comes with a price tag of several thousand dollars.
I'd just like to say that I'm very grateful for this and that we are very lucky to have this.
Kimberly is 4 years old now. Aside from a dental surgery that had to be done in the hospital, she doesn't have many medical needs.
We do a lot of preventative appointments, like the Can Be Healthies and the immunizations, just regular dental checkups.
Those immunizations protect not only Kimberly, but everyone around her. They ensure that she doesn't come down with vaccine-preventable diseases and spread them to others at daycare and around the community. Even though young children and their mothers, like Kimberly and Jessica Corrado, make up by far the biggest share of Medicaid recipients in Kansas, the cost of their coverage is relatively low, just $240 a month per member. It costs 10 times that amount for each elderly Kansan whose nursing home care is covered by Medicaid. And the cost for Kansans with disabilities are often higher still. Roger Martin is a freelance writer in Lawrence who recently wrote a commentary about his own mother's experience with Medicaid.
Her voice drops with shame as she says she's on Medicaid. How did she get there? First, she lived longer than she thought possible. She's 95 years old. She never dreamed she'd live this long. And if she hadn't, she wouldn't have to accept Medicaid. She was saved by a surgeon from a kinked colon that was ready to rupture. After the surgery, she had to leave independent living and move to a skilled nursing unit. She had been paying about $2,500 a month. In skilled nursing, the cost tripled. Her nest egg shattered. So, last year we applied for Medicaid. Several times Mom said she's receiving charity, despite my assurances that she paid into the system for years. I've also tried to remind her that for years, she's been the giver, not the taker. My mother's helped organizations that serve the poor, the paralyzed, and the war-torn. The blind, the hungry, the diseased, here and overseas. Until last year, she'd send them checks for $5, $10, $20. Today, it makes her sad to toss their mailings into the trash. Being a teenager during the Great Depression taught her to be frugal. When I was a kid, she'd bank $1 a week in a Christmas Club account so she could buy us gifts. For years, she logged the cost of Christmas presents in her diaries. In 1952, she spent almost $6 apiece on toy guns and holsters for me and my brother, and $2.98 for Grandpa's long underwear. She also recorded money-saving tips. In one diary, for example, there's a recipe for restoring a faded umbrella with a mixture of ammonia and water. So is this woman entitled to our collective help through a program like Medicaid? I don't know. But she is my mom. What if she were yours?
The thoughts of Roger Martin, a freelance writer who lives in Lawrence. For Jim McLean of the KHI News Service, I'm Brian Thompson, Kansas Public Radio.
Medicaid is the second largest program the state of Kansas operates. Only education consumes more dollars in the state budget, and Medicaid costs have been growing at a faster pace than most other programs. Officials in Governor Sam Brownback's administration say they are giving the program a complete overhaul in order to control costs and improve care. More from KPR's Brian Thompson and Jim McLean of the KHI News Service.
Transforming Medicaid was an early priority for Republican Governor Sam Brownback. He formally launched the initiative with the appointment of a task force in November of 2011.
Even before I was in office, I was talking about the needs that we had in Medicaid and to get Medicaid better organized to serve the current constituency that gets Medicaid services, the same numbers at least or more, and to serve with better quality of service.
Brownback says about one-fourth of the state budget is funded by federal money, and he worries that efforts to reduce the nation's budget deficit could put some of those federal funds at risk. 60% of the nearly $3 billion needed to pay for Medicaid comes from Washington. The state had been using federal stimulus funds to pay for Medicaid. When that money dried up, Brownback turned to the transportation budget to plug the gap during his first year in office.
Department of Transportation, I think, put in $200
million,
but who's counting, right? $205 million into Medicaid this year so that we didn't have to cut people on Medicaid as a number of other states have cut. We were able to do this one time. Now, how can we get our costs more under control?
CanCare is Brownback's plan to control Medicaid costs by contracting with three private companies to provide care to the approximately 380,000 Kansans enrolled in the program. Until now, low-income children and families have been in a managed care program called HealthWave. Senior citizens who can't afford their nursing home care and Kansans with disabilities have been in the traditional fee-for-service Medicaid program. That means they've been free to seek care from any Medicaid provider, and the state has paid the bill. Now the state has agreed to pay a fixed rate for everyone in the program in exchange for the companies providing them with a full range of medical, psychiatric, and long-term care services. The contractors must pay the doctors and other providers at least as much as they would have received under the old system. They're also expected to serve all those eligible under the old system without reducing benefits. Lieutenant Governor Jeff Collier says the way for the companies to make money is to make Medicaid more efficient and to emphasize preventive care.
About 25% of people on Medicaid consume roughly 60-70% of the program. Those are people with very complex problems across multiple agencies. The goal is to get them better care. So instead of ending up at the hospital six times in a year, you actually have a care coordinator for integrated care so that maybe they're only in the hospital three or four times.
Hospital care is expensive. If CanCare can reduce the need for hospital care, the savings could be substantial.
When we originally started looking at this, we estimated we would save about $830 billion. We've contracted for savings of at least $1 billion in savings for Kansas over the next 5 years.
That doesn't mean that Medicaid costs will go down. It just means they won't go up as much as they would have under the old system. And Collier says the managed care companies have also promised to add some services not previously available under Medicaid.
Through the power of competition, we were now able to add a basic dental benefit that didn't exist before. We start providing for obesity care. And remember those people that couldn't get a heart transplant? Well, now we at least are going to have the opportunity to do that.
In response to concerns that managed care companies will delay or reduce services to maximize profits, Collier says the state will hold back $500 million in payments to make sure the three private contractors live up to their promises. So just who are these companies that the Brownback administration is placing so much faith in? Jim McLean of the KHI News Service has more.
They are three big for-profit companies and they're fierce competitors. First, there's Minnesota-based United Healthcare. It's the nation's largest insurance company and expects to generate about $124 billion in earnings this year. Next, there's Amerigroup. It was already pretty big, but it got much bigger recently when it was gobbled up by WellPoint, which insures more than 36 million people across the country. The Indianapolis-based company paid nearly $5 billion for Amerigroup, mainly to gain a foothold in the Medicaid managed care market. St. Louis-based Centene is the smallest of the three companies managing contracts in Kansas, where it operates as the Sunflower State Health Plan. And because it's growing fast and focused almost exclusively on Medicaid, its finances are the most volatile. Problems with contracts in Texas and Kentucky recently forced Centene to downgrade its earnings forecast. Nevertheless, CEO Michael Neidorff recently told financial analysts that the way back to profitability was to keep growing the company's footprint by winning new state contracts.
Growth and our performance will be dependent upon our ability to win new business. We have a solid history of winning competitive bids with a 100% success rate in 2011 and a win rate of 89% in 2012.
Handing Medicaid over to large for-profit companies makes some consumers, advocates, and providers nervous. They worry the companies will cut services to maximize profits. But Deborah Donahue, a financial analyst for Mark Farah and Associates, who closely follows the industry, says that isn't the approach that companies seeking long-term profits typically take.
The reality is what the managed care industry brings is a lot of high technology services that actually look at who is the population that needs care, needs preventative services, and gets them those preventative services so that it reduces care down the line.
For KPR's Brian Thompson, I'm Jim McLean of the KHI News Service.
We just heard the first two parts in a five-part series by Kansas Public Radio about the new CanCare. Find links on our website, kcur.org, for more information, and as the week goes on, the rest of the series.
Coming up, a local researcher pushes the National Institutes of Health to look at the diversity of grant recipients. You're listening to KC Currents.
This is KC Currents. I'm Alex Smith.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. 3 years ago, Kansas City police reopened one of the most vexing cold cases in local history. It was the 1970 murder of politician and civil rights leader Leon Jordan. The case was reopened after an investigation by Kansas City Star reporters Mike McGraw and Glenn Rice. McGraw told us what one of the original detectives told him about the 40-year-old case.
I can't remember a case with less information, more blind alleys, more possible motives, and more possible suspects than the Leon Jordan murder.
But in 2011, the case was finally closed. Police identified the murderer as James Doc Dearborn, a leader in a crime organization called the Black Mafia. It was a complicated story involving politicians and both white and black mobsters. Some people who still remember Leon Jordan were concerned that the circumstances of his death may have overshadowed his groundbreaking accomplishments in Kansas City. Former Mayor Pro Tem Alvin Brooks says the older generation remembers Leon Jordan and his legacy here. But younger people say,
yeah, I kind of remember Leon Jordan. Did he get killed? Something happened to kill somebody? Or wasn't he owning something? Oftentimes, we don't pass people on to each other, I think, the way we should.
But throughout the reopening and reclosing of the Jordan murder case, one man has been deep in an investigation of the story of Leon Jordan's life. Robert Farnsworth is a professor emeritus of English at UMKC. He recently finished a biography called Leon Mercer Jordan, the founder of Freedom, Inc., following in the footsteps of his father and grandfather. It's been published online through UMKC's Labud Special Collections. Susan Wilson and I spoke to Farnsworth back in 2010 when the murder case was reopened, and he shared with us Jordan's story. We're going to re-air that interview today. Farnsworth moved to Kansas City in 1960 to teach at what was then the University of Kansas City, and he met Jordan soon after. In early 1961, Farnsworth and his wife were asked to hold a meeting at their home for a new chapter of the civil rights group CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality.
And most of us were white, except for the Jordans and the Blankenships, two prominent black couples whom I didn't know at that time. This field rep wanted us to get organized and wanted us to elect officers. And since most of us didn't know each other, there was a lot of fumbling around, and somebody suggested that I become chairman of the group, and I think it was primarily because the meeting was at my home, and I said I didn't think that was appropriate since I was relatively new in Kansas City and particularly didn't know the black community. And at that point, Leon rhetorically put his arm around me and said, I'll introduce you to the black community.
The civil rights years that followed were a wild ride. And though Farnsworth says he and Jordan were never personally very close, he credits Leon Jordan with inspiring an interest in what would become his academic specialty, African-American literature, which eventually, 50 years later, led Farnsworth back to research the story of Jordan's life.
He had grown up in a very comfortable house economically. His grandfather had come and was seen in the black community as a relatively wealthy man. He invested in real estate quickly. He was a barber. He had a good source of income. And he had a very large family who were often in the news.
Jordan's father died when Jordan was only 13 years old. Farnsworth says he thinks losing his father at a young age was traumatic. Jordan ended up switching schools a lot and joined the army at the age of 15. It was 1919, just after the end of World War I. But he was kicked out soon after they discovered his age. Eventually, Leon Jordan graduated from Wilberforce College in Ohio. He worked as a teacher and social worker before finding a job as a police officer.
At that time, Tom Pendergast ran this town, including the police force. And Farnsworth says Pendergast supposedly interviewed every police candidate himself.
When Pendergast fell, the first thing that happened was that the police department came under the control of the governor to clean it up. And he appointed a new police chief from the FBI who brought in a whole different method of organization and investigation. And it was very righteous and very, very scientific and all that sort of thing.
Farnsworth says Jordan thrived under the new leadership, and he and his partner were often written up in local newspapers.
Tom Webster, who was head of the Urban League at that time, frequently wrote letters to the police chief suggesting that they ought, either Cliff Warren or Leon Jordan had shown their ability and ought to be given much more administrative responsibility for their achievements.
And a promotion soon arrived, but not in Kansas City, not even in the United States. In 1947, the president of the West African country of Liberia called on Jordan to modernize the police force there. Jordan took a leave of absence from the KCPD. It was a challenge both he and his wife embraced.
As head of the constabulary in Liberia, he had access to President Tubman. They had dinners together, that sort of thing. And he was, you know, in the top echelons of society. And he was in with all the diplomatic corps. The French ambassador had given him a medal.
Leon Jordan had learned to fly before he went to Liberia. He had his own plane there. And Orca Jordan set up modern fingerprint and photography labs for the police force. But Farnsworth says Jordan never intended to stay permanently.
He came back here to Kansas City to see what all this would mean in terms of his advancement in the police department. They did promote him to a lieutenancy, and it was the first black lieutenancy in the police department, but they assigned him to the Flora Street station, and he was doing the same thing that he had done before, and he was only in charge of black officers, very limited, and there was no way he was going to accept this. And so he resigned, and he went back to Liberia. But this created a midlife crisis, in a sense. What was he going to do with his life?
Jordan returned to Kansas City again in 1954. He eventually bought the Green Duck Tavern on Prospect and 26th Street and sort of apprenticed himself to some local Democratic political leaders.
The black vote was often bought, or controlled by these kind of political leaders, and it was pretty notorious. And then he and Bruce Watkins decided it was time that the political problem of the black community was its control by white politicians. Not just political control, but through the political control, it also included a great deal of economic exploitation. So I think he and Bruce both decided that it was time for the black political leadership to be beholden only to the black community and not to white political bosses. So they developed a theme, throw the plantation bosses out.
Watkins and Jordan joined forces with Charles Moore, Fred Curls, and Howard Maupin to form Freedom Incorporated in 1960. Jordan became chair. And in the very next year, the fledgling political group helped elect Bruce Watkins and Earl Thomas as Kansas City's first African-American council members.
In 1964, Jordan and Harold Holliday Sr. became the first African-American state representatives from Kansas City. Later that year, Freedom Inc. took on its first major citywide referendum, a vote on public accommodations, which would end segregation in public facilities and businesses like restaurants, buses, and stores. Farnsworth says this vote was a test for freedom.
It's very interesting. The Public Accommodations Act this time had the support of much of the white leadership, both politically and in church and social situations. But when it came down to the vote, the only reason the ordinance passed was because the black community came out so overwhelmingly in support of it. The white vote was negative, total, and it was a significant tribute to the organization of the black vote. It gave freedom a kind of authenticity within the black community. There's always been something of a question when you establish a black political party, is this just another faction? What is a faction? Does it make a difference whether you have black or white leaders, depending on how that works out? This was an election which Freedom worked very hard at. It was an election in which the community saw the advantages of what they won. They were public and demonstrable. It was not something that lined any one person's pockets. There was no economic advantage. It was not some sort of payoff in any other sense. It was something that I think gave pride to the community and gave a sense that, hey, we've got somebody speaking for us now. And I think in that sense, Freedom gained a sense of power and responsibility to represent the black community.
In his research for a biography of political leader Leon Jordan, Robert Farnsworth finds that Jordan was successful partly because he was able to link what Freedom Inc. was doing locally to the national civil rights movement.
He was, in some ways, pretty imaginative, and he knew how to make significant deals, not just in local scene, but he played a key role in the careers of Richard Bowling and of Tom Eagleton. And so, in a sense, his influence reached both to the state and the federal government for good reasons. And he used that, and in some ways, what he did in both of those instances was ultimately very important for the civil rights movement in general. These were important leaders. What I'm learning and am a little surprised by is the fact that he was the boss. I've come across more and more testimony from Bruce Watkins, part of it published in The Call after Leon's death, and part of it in affidavits in the police file, etc., that made it quite clear that Leon called the shots. He was the architect. I've often tried to figure out how Freedom worked, you know, what kind of organization did they have. I knew some of the people that were involved. I particularly knew Harold Holliday. And Harold Holliday is not a compliant man. I mean, he was a man of considerable independence and strength and very outspoken. He didn't hesitate to speak up and voice his opinion. And apparently Leon listened to many people and took ideas from different people. But in the end, it was Leon who controlled the money and the decisions. He was a political boss. And in some ways, I think that's sad, because I don't think he left a political structure that was institutionalized enough, structured enough, to carry on his work after he left. And I don't think Freedom has ever been the same. Now, I don't think that's the only reason that Freedom has never been the same.
Farnsworth says it's clear that Jordan was worried about the future of the organization.
He was very concerned about being able to pass on authority in Freedom, and he developed young leadership, and he had faith in those. One or two instances, I'm not so sure he chose the right people, but in the last years of his life, he clearly was ready to pass on that leadership. He was growing old, and I think that was also part of the problem in his death. I think he was ready to retire, ready to hand on, and there are several evidence of that. He came into conflict with a whole new generation of young black leaders, the black nationalist movement that he questioned and criticized and came into conflict with and tried to relate to, but it was a very uncomfortable mix. You know, it's clear after a while, a new generation just likes to shoulder the older one out of the way. And that was beginning to happen in some instances.
To finish his biography, Professor Farnsworth had to tackle the murder. And one of the last documents he read was the 900-page police file on the case.
It's scary, some of the things that I've seen in that file. Scary in terms of the violence of the drug culture that was in the black community at that time, and which were, in a way, trying to infiltrate the political organizations as well. And Leon did have some personal relations with some of the people involved, and it's complicated to try to explain or even to understand.
There were some difficult aspects to the man so many admired. For one thing, he had an eye for beautiful women.
Orchid tried to control it, tried to limit him in some ways, and then seemed to grow kind of tolerant as long as it didn't become too obvious and too public. They seemed still to continue to maintain a respect for each other and a concern for each other. Ironically enough, on the night of Leon's death, Orchid expected him to come home with some ice cream. And that was apparently a ritual that they carried out regularly. He often, at the end of work, would come home with ice cream that they shared.
Orchid Jordan would end up taking over her husband's seat in the Missouri State Assembly for the next 16 years. They had no children together, which Farnsworth says might be one of the reasons his contributions to Kansas City history have not been remembered the way they should be. UMKC Professor Emeritus Robert Farnsworth will be discussing his biography of Leon Mercer Jordan next Sunday afternoon at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. Check our website for more information. This story was first broadcast as part of a series in 2010.
When researchers submit proposals to the National Institutes of Health to get funding, they don't indicate their race or ethnicity. But black researchers are a third less likely than other equally qualified researchers to receive NIH funding. That's according to a study by KU economics professor Donna Ginther, who researched the topic for the institutes in 2008. Earlier this week, Susan Wilson spoke with Ginther about her findings. Ginther says the medical community needs researchers who better reflect the demographics of the population.
Diversity gives a different perspective on issues related to science. So an example, the first knee replacement, right? The knee joint was developed, the artificial knee was developed by men, and they put artificial knees for men in women. Well, women's physical structure is different, and it took a woman joining the team to point out that these knees are not going to work for women. So if you get a diversity of perspectives, you get a diversity of approaches to science, and it leads to better science. So if everybody who's doing science is white and male, and there are issues that are related to race, ethnicity, and gender, and that's not reflected in the experience of scientists, you're going to get a very narrow perspective on science relative to something that will embrace the diversity of the population. And, you know, the NIH's mission is to improve the health of all Americans.
Tell me a little bit more about how you actually conducted the study.
Well, NIH said, here's our data. These are all of the applications for R01, which are the main research funding mechanism, R01 grants from 2000 to 2006. And as we sort of put the study together, we added more information about the researchers' education background, their research background, to try to understand those factors that would account for the success or lack of success in receiving NIH funding. So we took about a year to put the data together, and then we analyzed it. And my goal was to explain the gap. You had this gap in the raw data, and if we could explain the gap by training and education and research productivity, then, you know, pinpointing the factors that affected the gap would allow you to have better policy to address the gap. Well, we found the gap. We weren't really able to explain it. And at that point, we presented the results to the NIH leadership, and they wanted, you know, they thought it would be a good idea to get this information out in the open so that they could start affecting policy. And so that's when we sent the paper to Science, and it was reviewed and then published in August of 2011.
Now, when you say you weren't able to explain the findings, I know you looked at some factors. What factors did you look at, and why was it difficult to explain what was happening?
So we looked at their educational background, whether or not they received NIH training, their affiliation, the number of publications and citations they had. These are all factors that you would expect to have an influence on whether or not you receive NIH funding. And they were good predictors for receiving NIH funding for the whole group, but they didn't really explain why Black and Asian applicants were less likely to receive funding. We were able to explain the Asian difference, and that was 80% of applicants in the Asian group are from foreign countries, and it could be language issues that affect how clearly they write proposals. We haven't actually read the proposals, but that would be a potential explanation. Once you looked at U.S.-born Asians, there's no difference between them and whites in terms of getting funding. But we still had this unexplained gap between Black and white researchers. Black researchers were 13 percentage points. We were less likely than whites to get funded. We were able to explain about a third of that so that they turned out to be 10 percentage points less likely, still making them one third less likely than whites to receive funding.
Do black researchers tend to research areas different than other researchers, and do they tend to be in areas like that maybe NIH views as less scientific, more community-based, that they're not as interested in funding? Is that a factor?
We tried looking at that, and it was a very complicated problem. We know that if you have human subjects in your research, the funding hurdle is higher. But for blacks using human subjects, actually in medical schools, blacks using human subjects were disadvantaged. So if you were an MD, a black MD using human subjects, you were disadvantaged to a black MD not using human subjects. So what we found, we did a follow-up study that was published in November of last year, and we found that black MDs working in medical schools, if they were doing clinical research, that explained part of the black-white funding gap. And if for blacks not doing clinical research in medical schools, we found that they were not as disadvantaged. So there is some evidence that the topics that black researchers do may influence their funding probabilities. But sort of like if you look at the whole scope of what NIH funds, we tried to sort of narrow down and see if there were race, ethnicity differences in topics, but we weren't able to really discern that, those patterns in the time that we had. And as a result, it's a topic for future research.
We're talking today with KU economist Donna Genther about a recent study she did regarding NIH research and minority participation. When we get into your recommendations, what kinds of recommendations do you have to remedy this situation?
You're left with this unexplained gap. There are two potential and unpalatable explanations. The first is that there's bias in the review process, and the second is that the proposals are not of high enough quality to be funded. And there are two different approaches to addressing these explanations. So it's sort of like you have, you know, if you're a medical doctor, you have symptoms. You don't know what the underlying disease is necessarily, but you start treating the symptoms. And so the way you treat the symptom of bias in the review process is what NIH is doing, which is experimenting with having anonymous reviews to see if a proposal that was submitted with all of the information on the researcher is treated differently than if you remove all of that information.
Is this to address any possibility of unconscious bias? There's been a lot of studies done about, you know, the biases we have when we look at candidates for a job or candidates for admission to school.
Yes, it's trying to see if that is playing a role in the review process. And last year, the National Science Foundation experimented with this. They took a full proposal, and then they took a subset of those proposals and said, write up 4 pages describing your research, but don't put your name on it. And they sent those proposals back through the review process, and the proposals with names attached turned out to be reviewed differently than the proposals without the names.
Now, were some of the names like ethnic sounding or?
I don't.
Because that's.
I just read a report about the NSF process.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, it could be that it's removing ethnic sounding names. But it could be, you know, there's a Matthew effect and a halo effect. So the Matthew effect is that you have a great track record, so it's expected that in the future you'll continue to have a great track record. So people who are established, well-known scholars are given the benefit of the doubt. That's how I interpret the Matthew effect. Then there's the halo effect, meaning if you're from a prestigious institution, you're treated differently than if you're from a less prestigious institution. So if, say, for example, you're from John Hopkins, you know, one of the premier medical schools in the country, then a proposal from Hopkins is, again, sort of because you're at Hopkins, you're given more of a boost. And actually, we see that in our data. If you're at a very top-ranked institution, you're significantly more likely to get funded. Now, the question is it that the, you know, John Hopkins is able to pick the best scientists, or is it the fact that they're at John Hopkins that improves their outcomes? We don't know. These are just correlations. They're not causal.
Well, you know, in terms of the national budget, research is something where dollars seem to be research is an area where dollars seem to be shrinking. So how do you respond to the critics who say, look, for any researcher, you have to fight for every grant dollar that you get these days because the resources are so short? And why should race, ethnicity have anything to do with it?
Well, you know, my perspective is it's not race, ethnicity. It's about sort of leveling the playing field, giving everybody the opportunity to be successful and letting them compete on science. I mean, when I wrote my first NIH grant, you know, it was rejected. It didn't even get a score, which meant that it was in the lower half of the quality ranking. And that's because I didn't know how to write an NIH grant. I asked a friend of mine who had NIH funding if I could take a look at her grant. And wow, you know, it's a different, there's a whole different way of doing it than other grants that I'd written before. Well, if I hadn't had that help, I would never have received NIH funding in the first place. And it's about sort of this tacit knowledge, these rules or sort of ways of doing things that unless somebody takes you aside and tells you, you're not going to know. And, you know, there's a lot of evidence that says people tend to mentor those who look like them, right? People tend to work with people who have shared experiences. And if you don't have, you know, if there are very few black researchers, who's going to mentor the new researchers coming in? I mean, so I think that just equipping everyone with the same opportunity to be successful, giving them sort of the knowledge and the know-how about how to do the NIH grant correctly will help to sort of level the playing field and make everybody better at writing their science.
Well, Donna, thank you for joining us today on KC Currents, and best wishes in your future research.
Thank you, Susan. It's my pleasure.
Donna Ginther is an economics professor and director of the Center for Science, Technology, and Economic Policy at the Institute for Policy and Social Research, KU. She spoke to KC Currents' Susan Wilson. Ginther's study has prompted the National Institutes of Health to fund undergraduate research and to create a national researcher mentoring network. These programs are designed to help researchers gain experience and understand the funding process better. The NIH is also funding more studies by Ginther to look more closely at the funding gap.
After the break, we remember jazz saxophonist Eddie Saunders. This is KC Currents. This is KC Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Alex Smith, sitting in for Susan Wilson. Kansas City saxophone player and jazz singer Eddie Saunders passed away on December 30th. He was 80 years old. The late Lucky Wesley of the Scamps came up with Saunders and described him as nice. Naughty, but nice. Saunders loved to sing, and he loved to play, and he was proud of his Kansas City jazz heritage. KCUR's Suzanne Hogan has this remembrance.
The two main things that come up when you talk to friends about musician Eddie Saunders are that he was happiest when he was playing songs and that he was one hell of a fun guy to hang out with.
Charles Gustave said about him that when he thinks about it, he got more belly laughs with Eddie than with anyone else he knew.
Listen to the band. That's where we are.
Brian Morahan and Charles Gachet played with Eddie in the Blue Note 4 in the 80s up until his health kept him from gigging. Brian played the drums for the group and gave the eulogy at Eddie's funeral.
I could hear one note of Eddie's playing, and I know it's Eddie. You know, when Eddie would play a riff, for instance, You know, he wouldn't just play da 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 da. He would play wah 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 wah. There was a shape to each note. It was sculpture. Also, when you listen to Eddie, he's talking on his tenor all the time. He's always playing phrases, and now you know what he's saying, sort of.
Yeah, what kind of phrases stick out?
Well, some of them are curses, and some of them are quotes from other songs, and some of them, I want some seafood, mama, or da 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 da.
You can say it.
Well, you're just a dirty moya hoya. Things like that. You hear other tenor players do it, too, a lot.
Eddie developed his jazz chops long before the Blue Note 4.
You know, what the old-timers would say is, this was Eddie's approach, was play it pretty and tell a story.
Eddie's story starts with the old-timers back in the 30s and 40s, who are becoming harder to find these days. He was part of the infamous Kansas City lot that came up in the Parade Park neighborhood, which includes 18th and Vine, 12th Street, Euclid, Highland, streets that make up a neighborhood of jazz hotspots, the Musicians Foundation, and other clubs. This area is also home to Lincoln High School, all places where Eddie spent a lot of time growing up. Brian Morahan remembers the story that Eddie told him how Ben Webster, a.k.a. the Brute, or Frog, an influential sax player, had moved to Kansas City and would pick up Eddie in his big Lincoln convertible with his big black dog. They'd ride around all night while Eddie showed him the hotspots. He was just a teenager.
You know, he got to hang out with Ben, and in the morning he would drop him off at the front of Lincoln High School. That's how people learn.
That was the scene in those days. Eddie was coming up after other Kansas City sax players, Charlie Parker and Lester Young, hanging out in the park on 29th and Paseo with Eddie Cleanhead Vinson, running around with Lucky Wesley, Money Nash. They were all neighbors.
It was just a lot of talent in the neighborhood. Everyone was very highly encouraging.
Kansas City jazz singer and pianist Lukman Hamza remembers.
I enjoyed my childhood. I met Eddie in the kindergarten. We were together all during our young years, and we were just pretty much like brothers. We made a lot of music together.
Lukman started the Four Steps, which later became the Five Aces, a singing group when he was 12 years old. It imitated the sounds of the Ink Spots, which we're hearing now, and other crossover R&B artists of the time.
With the sun and the rain, or its lovely promise won't come true.
See, because those groups came out of a situation where they was barely eating, trying to stick together so that they could try to make a recording that can kind of give them a chance to live better.
Eddie, who loved to sing, wanted to be a part of the group.
He kind of bulldozed his way into the group. He loved the group, but he had so much talent. We were still learning, and I was about 17 when I got a union card.
Eddie sang bass in the Five Aces and joined the musician union at the same time as Lukman. They played around town with traveling acts and local groups like the Scamps. And after a while, most of the guys went their own ways for a bit. Eddie went off to fight in the Korean War. He ended up traveling the country with singer Lloyd Price in his band. That's him playing the sax in the hit Stagger Lee in 1957.
Eddie told Lloyd Price he couldn't sing. Lloyd Price fired him. he was an outspoken, you know, but he just, in other words, he just kind of let him know, man, you ain't singing nothing, you know. Kind of rough to say something like that when you're 1,300 miles from home.
There was work, and then there was no work. He toured Cuba and played around before Castro, and was even there when Castro came back and took over the country. It was there that he learned the mambo. And the thing about a lot of these guys, Lukman, Eddie, and his Kansas City crew, was that a lot of them left Kansas City and did their own thing for a while.
It was like maybe break time.
But then they came back.
People who lived in Kansas City, they had beautiful friendships, and even now, I'm performing on 18th Street. I usually refer to 18th Street as being my living room, and Kansas City as being my mama.
Eddie Saunders' life was music.
In his later years, he played with a lot of different groups. Based in Kansas City, he toured Europe and went around the country, played local gigs whenever he could. He had a stroke in 2006 that left him paralyzed on one side and made it hard for him to speak.
You know, he sang Send Me Someone to Love a lot. You know, he just had this beautiful, soulful voice. He was a lot of fun. He was really a very good friend. Music made him happiest. You know, I miss having him around. You know, I'm just going to miss him now.
Heavenly peace be to all mankind. Understanding and peace of mind. If it's not asking too much, please send me someone to love. My music is the soul of the universe.
Yeah. That's Eddie. He'd say that a lot. Music is the soul of the universe. He passed away when he was 80 years old and lays to rest in Leavenworth National Cemetery. For KCUR News, I'm Suzanne Hogan.
Hate is gone. If it's not asking too much, please send me someone to love. Oh, someone to love. I lie awake nights, find the world full of trouble. My answer is always the same. Let's man put an end to his damnable sin. They will put the world into flame. What a shame. Just because I'm in I don't beg for no sympathy. If it's not asking too much, please send me someone to love. Oh, send me someone.
Thanks for tuning in to Casey Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows at the Casey Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast. Find us on iTunes. Contact us at kcurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at Casey Currents.
Casey Currents is produced by Sylvia with assistant producer Suzanne Hogan. Our intern is Zach Lewandowski, and our theme music is by Approach. I'm Alex Smith.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.